first off, you're a noted linguist and a pioneer in the field. You know, imagine your audience is not familiar with linguistics. Why does this area of study matter to them? How does it impact their lives?
Well, the most it's been recognized for many centuries that the most distinctive intellectual cognitive characteristic of humans, and in fact the core of their nature, is the ability to use their language freely, creatively, independently. This is the foundation of a good part of Cartesian philosophy. It goes right through modern history. And it's an obvious fact. There are 7 billion humans in the world and a few tens of thousands of monkeys. And a part of the main reason for it is that humans have language. So to understand and to discover the nature of this quite remarkable ability is a fundamental question for anyone concerned with the nature of human beings.
Recently, we've seen a brush with American involvement in another military engagement. What are some of the language that those in power use to seduce Americans into another military engagement? What are some of the signs that we can signs of propaganda that we ought to watch for?
Well, for example, there's a notion that right now there's debate going on, lively debate between what's called exceptionalism and isolationism. Exceptionalism is the view that we are so marvelous and amazing that we must continue to devote our blood and resources to solving other people's problems all over the world, as we've been doing for 7 decades, as Obama put it the other night. Isolationism is described as the view that, yes, indeed, we are amazing and unique, but we better attend to our own problems rather than putting out the fires lit by these unworthy foreigners. That's the debate. There's also a truth to the matter. The truth to the matter is that for Obama's 7 decades, we've been a rogue state, violating international law, invading other countries, overthrowing democratic governments, installing brutal dictatorships. We've left a trail of blood and misery and destruction right up to the present. But that's just fact. Propaganda tells us we're not allowed to look at that fact. These are insignificant facts. What matters is the ideal conception of the United States as a uniquely exceptional idealistic country. Actually, this was put rather well by Hans Morgenthau, the founder of hard-headed, no-nonsense, realist international relations theory. He argued that the United States is unique among countries in history in that it has a purpose, a transcendental purpose. The purpose is equality, freedom, all wonderful things. But he was a good scholar, and he reviewed the record briefly, and he said that if you look at the record, it looks like as though the United States hasn't really attained its, lived up to its transcendental purpose. But he says to criticize the transcendental purpose in these grounds, on these grounds, is like the error of atheism, which denies God's goodness by looking at evil in the world. And his point, though this is not what he intended, is correct. It's a religion. It's a secular religion. And contrary evidence just doesn't matter. That's the most extreme form of propaganda that one can imagine. There are very few historical analogs to such a successful propaganda campaign. So the debate is the alleged debate is waged within a framework which is so dramatically false that you can hardly even laugh at it. But as Morgenthau said, that's irrelevant since we have a religion which claims that the premises are correct.
So, Dr. Chomsky, in your new book, on Western terrorism from Hiroshima to drone warfare, I believe that the argument that you just gave is really the subtext of that book, and it really is an indictment of U.S. foreign policy. So given that the exceptionalism stance has turned into its own religion or its own false idol, as some would say, and that false idol has overtaken the ability to reason out the true facts and ultimate carnage of our current policy, what would you say is the right U.S. foreign policy, and how could we actually get to, you know, a better standing in the world?
Well, actually, there were some several far-reaching polls by the major polling agencies a couple of years ago, which asked people about these questions, and they gave answers, which I wrote about them. I thought they were pretty sound. I wouldn't have put it quite that way, but I basically thought that the public opinion on this was sound. The public holds that by considerable margins, that in international crises, the United Nations should take the lead, not the United States. And the United States should go along with the will of the majority. In fact, a majority of the public even thought that the veto should be given up at the United Nations for everyone, and that if the United States didn't like, as not too many people know, the United States is way in the lead in the United Nations in vetoing Security Council resolutions. Britain second, no one else even close. That's since 1965, when the UN became moderately representative of world opinion. That's not well known, but it's a fact. Anyhow, the slight majority of the public thought that the U.S. should just go along with world opinion without a veto, even if we don't like it. Well, I think that's pretty sensible. That's pretty much the doctrines of the founding fathers, who insisted that we should have a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. And I think, and in other respects too, I think public opinion has been fairly sound, except in those unique moments when a massive propaganda drives people into a kind of hysteria. So immediately, right when the Bush administration, for example, was planning to invade Iraq, its worst crime of this millennium, there was a flood of propaganda about how if we don't quickly invade, the next thing we'll hear from Iraq will be a mushroom cloud over New York. You probably remember that. And it got people were frightened enough. So that only in the United States, not anywhere else, that there was a majority of support for this act of blatant criminal aggression. But those are rare moments, and the propaganda really has to be geared up to a massive level to achieve that. Most of the time, the public is pretty sound. Now, what is isolationism? If what's called isolationism is actually the view that we should observe international law, act like a law-abiding state, and not be a rogue state that claims the right to use violence when it feels like, claiming that it's for noble objectives, but. That makes about as much, you look at history, that's about as justifiable as other great powers that have made the same claim, and typically they do.
All right, this is primarily a media-focused podcast, and so I kind of wanted to get your opinion on how do you think that the American public should approach the mainstream media? In your opinion, are they still relevant and reliable?
Well, I'll just tell you my own practice. First thing I do in the morning, I just did it, in fact, is read a couple of newspapers, the New York Times, a couple of local quality newspapers, the business press, I turn to the international press, and that gives you, and then I go on to read a wide variety of journals across the spectrum, scholarly journals, books, and so on. But the major media are the main source of news and information. And generally, the facts are reliable. So, for example, what I was just describing is the framework of discussion. But within that framework, if you look at what's described, you learn a lot. You simply have to extricate yourself from the propaganda framework, which is so deeply entrenched that it's completely unconscious. I mean, this secular religion that I described is rather different from, say, evangelical Christianity or Orthodox Judaism, the culture I partially grew up in. My grandfather, for example, was an ultra-religious Jew, but he knew he was religious. The purveyors of the Orthodox of the state religion don't even know it. They think they have no beliefs. They're just being objective. That's a much higher level of subordination to religious doctrine. And people read the press, as they should if they want to know what's going on in the world, like, say, the New York Times, best newspaper in the world, in fact, should do so, learning what they can, but recognizing that the framework is of commentary and discussion is very sharply distorted by a religious doctrine that's pervasive. For example, right now there's article after article asking whether Iran is finally willing to negotiate with the United States. Well, anybody who bothers to look into it will quickly discover that it's the United States which has been blocking, not entirely, but significantly, blocking any steps towards negotiations. And in fact, when there were real achievements made that could have ended the crisis, the U.S. stepped in and blocked them. You have to do a little work to discover this, but it's in the press. So if you go back to 2010, Turkey and Brazil reached an agreement with Iran in which Iran would send all of its low-enriched uranium out of the country for storage to Turkey. And in return, the Western countries would provide isotopes for Iran's medical reactor. Okay, that would have ended the crisis. As soon as it was announced, it was bitterly denounced by the government here. Brazil was denounced. The press reflexively went along. It just repeats what the government says, denounced Brazil, denounced Turkey. Obama made quickly move to increase sanctions. The Brazilian foreign minister was sufficiently annoyed so that he released a letter from President Obama to President Da Silva of Brazil, in which Obama had made exactly this suggestion, apparently assuming that Iran wouldn't accept it, and then we'd have a propaganda point. But when they accepted it, it was denounced. Now, if you read the press carefully, really carefully, you can discover these facts, but you have to read it carefully. And once you and this is not the only one by any means. Once you learn these things, you can then approach the morning newspaper with a framework of understanding which will allow you to decode the distortions and find the facts. And it's incidentally very useful to read critical commentary, which is now easily available on the Internet, which goes through all these things.
You've referred to yourself as a libertarian socialist. How does that differ from the libertarianism best identified in Ron Paul, the Cato Institute, or the National Libertarian Party?
Well, the term libertarian in the United States has a meaning quite different from what it's meant traditionally in the long European tradition. There, libertarian just is the anti-state wing of the socialist movement. So the critics of the Bolsheviks from the left, left-wing critics of the Bolsheviks, who regarded Bolshevism as kind of a right-wing deviation, they were libertarian socialists. They didn't believe and they opposed the power of the tyrannical state. the term libertarian, and in fact, they opposed any form, libertarian socialists opposed any form of illegitimate authority and domination. American libertarians are quite different. They favor tyranny, but the tyranny of private power. They don't want the state to be in a position to restrict and limit the power of private capital concentrations, corporations. That's advocacy of a form of tyranny, a form of unaccountable private tyranny. And that's quite different from the libertarian tradition, which was opposed to tyranny of any kind.
If I may just ask one follow-up, I know we're long on time here. You know, we are more libertarian in the strain of Ron Paul and the Cato Institute, but you know, our view is that there should be no force, no coercion, and if individuals are acting in harmony with each other, then I don't see how that's tyranny necessarily.
If there's no rules. You can call them coercion, if you like driving on the right instead of driving anywhere you like. If there are no rules, then what will happen is very evident. We see it before us. There's plenty of historical evidence. Concentrations of capital will accumulate. They'll grow larger and larger. They'll be uncontrolled and unconstrained. They'll be predatory and destructive. And the free choices that you'll have will be either to submit to them with whatever constraints they impose, or to starve.
Well, we're long on time, but I wanted to thank you for indulging us in that one last follow-up there. So thank you very much, and we appreciate you taking the time to talk to our audience, and really have enjoyed talking to you.
Good to talk to you.